Are you still okay with me beginning with the New York Times op-ed thing that was so bizarre?
Oh, that's not even the most bizarre. Did you read the Washington Post book review?
No, I don't tend
Oh,
to read the
God.
Washington Post book review. No.
Just for your own entertainment, I'm going to send it to you after this. It's the snarkiest thing you've ever read. But yes, that is totally fine.
In the last 5 decades, since 1970, the expectation that children are almost always raised by two parents, the norm of a two-parent family, has become passé, deeply out of touch with reality. Single-parent families went from about 13% of all families in 1970 to 29.4% in 2024. Their percentage more than doubled. Last Saturday, November 25th, the New York Times published an opinion piece devoted to the topic of the rise of single-parent families. The piece was featured by the Times. It took up two-thirds of an entire page, far more massive than the usual piece. And the article centered on repeated criticisms of a brand-new book, Melissa Carney's The Two-Parent Privilege. According to the Times, scolds bemoaning the single-parent families don't know life in the trenches. And the article concluded, "Simply advising people to marry is not only, frankly, obnoxious for the many women out there trying, it's also just not going to work." Well, who is Melissa Carney? What are her ideas? And why does a New York Times think attacking her is so darn important? Welcome to the political conversation, Melissa Carney.
Thanks for having me.
Could I just ask you your reaction to reading that op-ed when it first arrived?
Sure. Well, that one, came on the heels on a few other that were penned in basically the 24 to 48 hours after my book hit the shelves. I think it was all very expected in the sense that, what you just read and the similar kind of reactions I get, I see them all really as just skirting the issues I'm raising. And there's no sense in which anyone can seriously engage with my book and walk away thinking that I'm just blithely telling people to get married. But to the contrary, my response to that is you can't just keep blithely ignoring the fact that the huge rise in the share of kids living with one parent, the fact that this has happened primarily among less economically successful families in the US, the fact that this is tremendously difficult for the parents who are parenting by themselves. We can't just dismiss that because acknowledging it somehow offends our feminist or modern sensibilities. So I'm undeterred, Wally.
Well, glad to hear that. You told a story a while back that I heard on another podcast about a presentation that Raj Chetty made and that you responded to some years ago that you described as playing a strong role in focusing you on the issue. Could you explain to the folks listening just who Raj Chetty is and why his prominence made this so significant and what happened?
Sure. So let me take a step back. Before the Raj Chetty work came, we had mounds of evidence showing at an individual level that kids who grew up with two parents in their household tended to have better outcomes, both during their childhood and in young adulthood, than kids who grew up, with just one parent in their household. Then Raj Chetty and his team started working some years ago with essentially millions of records, tax records on kids who grew up in the US in the 80s, 90s, 2000s. They're approaching adulthood now. They had all of these records at a neighborhood level. And one of their first pathbreaking studies that came out in 2014 mapped economic mobility across the US. And what they did was basically look at kids where they grew up and how they did in adulthood and mapped the rate of upward mobility for kids at a small neighborhood level. They correlated rates of upward mobility with neighborhood characteristics. What was so striking to me from that first paper is that the factors of a neighborhood most highly correlated with rates of mobility were all things that I would categorize as more cultural in concept than the typical economic or policy factors, in particular, the share of married parent households. That was the most highly correlated factor with rates of upward mobility. So this is beyond just an individual level, but what is it about communities that give rise to higher rates of upward mobility? In contrast to the strong correlation of factors like share of married parent households, share of single mother households, in contrast to that, things like EITC exposure, access to colleges, college tuition, those kinds of factors that have gotten much more attention from those of us in the economic policy world, they were much, you know, less predictive of rates of mobility. So I discussed that paper. Raj presented that work at a conference at a think tank in DC. I was invited to be a discussant, and I really focused on this fact that, hey, if we look at the factors of a neighborhood that are highly correlated, they're not the things we usually focus on. And I have to tell you, a woman came up to me after that talk. I don't know who it was, but she said to me, have you put all of this in a book? I said, no, I haven't. She said, well, you should. And actually, that woman just saying that to me, sort of that just kept, I don't know, a little bird on my shoulder saying, you should write all this down somewhere. And in sort of, you know, much subsequent work, not just that folks have been doing at the individual level, but more work that's come out of their Opportunity Insights Lab looking at the neighborhood level, this importance of family structure just keeps coming up over and over and over again. So finally, I did write the book.
And it's quite a work. I really very impressive. So
thank you.
Let's dive into some of the statistics, because your book is loaded with data. If you're data adverse, it's not a good read. If you want to use data and factual argument to figure out what the heck to do next, it's a beautiful read. Walk us through what's happening to marriage and to families in America over the last 40 years.
Sure. Well, one of the, you know, let's start with the big motivating fact, what's happening at an aggregate level. The share of kids in the U.S. growing up in married parent homes has fallen over the past 40 years from 77% in 1980 to about 63% now. That's really quite a stunning decrease. The reason why that matters so much is because it hasn't just been made up for with an increase in kids living with two stably cohabiting parents. So the reduction in marriage or married parent homes really has translated into an increase in kids living with one parent, such that a cross-section now of kids in the U.S. Census, we see 21% of them live with an unpartnered mother, so a mother who has neither a spouse nor an unpartnered or an unmarried partner in her house. About another 4.5% live with an unpartnered father. Another 4% live with no parents. About 8% of kids live with one of their biological parents and another parent figure that may or may not be their second biological parent. So this is a really large share of kids in the U.S. living outside a two-parent home. The second really important thing to know about this trend is that it masks a really large divergence between socioeconomic groups. So this decrease in married or two-parent homes for kids over the past 40 years has really been driven by an increase in single-parent households among adults or parents who don't have four-year college degrees. And so what has happened over the past 40 years is this emergence of a college gap in family structure. So back in the 1980s, there wasn't that much difference, but it was sort of like 80% of kids whose moms didn't have a high school degree lived in a, 80% of kids whose moms didn't have a high school degree lived with married parents as compared to 90% of kids whose parents had a four-year college degree. Now that gap is much wider. It's you know, massive now, 84% to 57%. And so there's just a really large educational gradient now.
Could we just stop? Yeah. I'm sorry.
It's okay. I'm like, there's so many numbers.
I know. There are so many numbers. But could we just, that last one is a doozy. And yes, Let's just take a second and say it over again and walk people through exactly what you just said about the prevalence of single parent
homes
among non-college educated kids.
Kids of non-college educated parents. I'm going to say it in two ways. If we just look at the share of kids living in married parent homes, among kids whose parents have a four-year college degree, that's only fallen from 90% to 84%, just a 6 percentage point gap in 40 years, even though the share of parents with a college degree has gotten so much bigger. Outside the college-educated class, there has been a tremendous decline. If you look at the middle of the education distribution, parents who have a high school degree in some college, but not a four-year degree. So these are parents who we might have considered in the middle class. The share of their kids growing up in married parent homes has fallen from 83% to 60%. It's a 23 percentage point decrease in four decades. Now, essentially, that middle group has converged to that of the most disadvantaged group. The most disadvantaged group, the share of kids living with married parents, fell from 80% to 57%. So again, stunning decreases outside the college-educated class. Another way to think about these gaps is let's just look at the share of kids living with unpartnered mothers. Among kids whose moms have a four-year college degree, so these are the moms who we think are probably the most readily able to take care of a household with their own economic earnings, only 12% of those children live with an unpartnered mother, as compared to 30% of kids whose moms don't have a four-year college degree, including moms who have a high school degree or some college. 30% of them live with unpartnered mothers. So, you know, you started with some pushback I'm getting. The pushback I'm getting from writers at the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, Salon, The Cut, those are really like feminist writers. Why feminists don't think that this is a travesty that millions of economically vulnerable women are raising kids in households by themselves, I do not understand. Feminists, I think, should be really concerned about the fact that those of us with college degrees and well-paying jobs, those of us who've benefited the most, I would say, from feminism's opening of economic opportunities, we're still raising her kids with the benefit of a partner in the home to a much greater extent than other women.
So you're not blaming, I mean, let's cut through it.
Yeah.
You're not blaming women struggling to raise children for doing bad job. Very different point you're making here. My wife and I were discussing this. We raised two children. I know you've had three children. It's hard work. It takes constant attention. It's just a massive commitment of your life to raise children. And to be the only person doing it is a stunning difficulty. So to folks like us, it sort of makes sense that having a second person on whom you can rely, a reliable person, not just a bad person, not just a body, a reliable partner, is a massive support for raising a child, for doing anything in your life.
Yeah, 100%.
Why can't that penetrate?
Yeah, no. I mean, look, you're kind about my book, but as I'm writing the book, some of it is I'm like, gosh, this is so obvious. I'm not even saying anything interesting. And then the next day, I'm like, oh gosh, this is so controversial. Do I really want to say this out loud? But it really is. I mean, the data speak for themselves, but it's also common sense, which is why. It's just a little bit surprising and frustrating that some people want to deny how difficult this is. And to your point, nobody, certainly not me, I'm not blaming single moms. Another thing about that point is I was presenting some of this work to a group of people who work with single moms. Many of them are single moms themselves. And I feel almost sheepish. So I'm putting up all this data from the American Time Use Survey, basically showing that married moms spend more time with their kids than unmarried moms. And again, we see it in the data, but it's not surprising if you're the only person who's there to go to work, to raise money, to drive the kids, to make the meals, to clean the house. You don't have as much time to sit and read to your kid as a married mom who is less likely to be the, you know, the sole earner in her household, and also has another adult in the household to share the tasks with. And afterwards, I was speaking with one of the single moms who saw my presentation, and you know, she's like, she felt validated by what I was showing her in some sense. And because, you know, she doesn't have the luxury of like, oh, let me look in the data to see if my experience is nationally representative, right? But she said to me, you know, my daughter always says to me, Mom, I wish you could find a husband so that he could mow the lawn and you could play with me. I mean, that's what it's like in the trenches, right? In some sense, the data is validating how hard it is for parents to do it by themselves.
So let's talk for a minute about the overall context in which this was happening. Over a 40-year period, there was a decline in marriage, there was a growth of single parenting, and at the same time that was going on in the economy in general, earnings inequality was growing. Yes. How do you see the two in relation to each other?
Yeah, I see arrows running both ways. So let's take the first set of arrows. The first thing that happened, you know, in terms of thinking about why did this happen? Why was there a divergence in family structure by education group? We know in the 60s and 70s, there's this cultural social revolution. It became more acceptable to not be married, to have kids outside marriage, different expectations. We saw a reduction in marriage across basically all education groups. And then going into the 80s and 90s and continuing in the early 2000s, we saw the marriage rate among college-educated adults basically stabilize. But the share of adults getting married and being, you know, who are married through their 30s, 40s, 50s in the among adults with a high school degree or less continued to decrease. Now, that comes at the same time as the earnings of college-educated men and women continued to rise. So college-educated adults did really well in the labor market. The employment rate of men outside, you know, without a college degree fell over this period. Their earnings were, you know, stagnant or decreased a bit. And women's earnings relative to men outside the college-educated class improved. And so the way I see this as an economist is the economic value proposition of marriage between a man and a woman decreased for adults outside the college-educated class. Why? Let's put this in plain English. You know, men are less likely to be reliable high earners. They're also less likely to bring in more than a woman could bring in on her own. So if you're on the margin of trying to decide, do I want to commit to this guy, or from the guy's perspective, do I want to commit to this family, the economic rationale for doing so was eroded. That didn't happen among college-educated adults. And so part of that story, right, that fits the trends. We also have very good causal evidence of causal connections between, you know, shocks that led to a reduction in manufacturing jobs, which were well-paid, family-sustaining jobs for men without a college degree in the U.S. In communities that lost those jobs, we subsequently see, again, tracing a causal line here, we see a reduction in marriage, an increase in the share of kids living in single mother homes, and an increase in child poverty. Similar story for communities where there was a loss of jobs to the adoption of industrial robots. There's another nice paper by Nama Shinov showing that because of industry composition in certain areas where women did better relative to men, you saw a reduction in marriage. And so this idea of, you know, how economic position of economic positioning affecting marriage rates and ultimately the share of kids living in single parent homes is fairly well established. That's the first point. The second point on this is the divergence in family structure has amplified these labor market dispersions such that there's more household inequality now than there would be just from labor market changes. So what do I mean there? College-educated adults, they've done very well. They've continued to marry each other, set up homes with two adults. High school-educated workers have seen stagnant wages with a 23 percentage point increase that there's only one earner in the household. And so at a very mechanical level, the economic security of that middle group has decreased in a way that's, you know, reflective of this decreased likelihood of having two adults in the household.
That concluded the first part of my conversation with Melissa Carney about her remarkable new book. In the second part of our conversation, we're going to dive deeply into the question of what can be done to really improve the earnings of American men. I'll see you next time on The Political Conversation.